Leadership Studies Lecture Series. It's a pleasure to have you here this evening. This, as Elaine was speaking to you, this is our fall series, and it's a thrill to be partnered with Book Passage these past 8 years that we've done this together with Book Passage. I just wanted to tell you a very brief description of what is our Institute for Leadership Studies. It is a center for leadership development. It seeks to facilitate positive individual, organizational, and social change, engaged citizenship, and socially responsible leadership. What better speaker could we have this evening than Professor Reich to help support that mission? So what is leadership? Is it an art? Is it a science? Yes. Yes, it is, both an art and a science. Is it an individual act? No. It is a group act. It's about taking initiative when others do not. It's about inspiring others to take ethical action to achieve needed change. It's visioning the future. It's fixing what is not broken. So each semester, we seek to support dialogues and discussion actively with our community about inspiring acts of leadership. As I said earlier, this is a cooperation between Book Passage and Dominican University of California, and I want to thank Elaine and Bill Petricelli for their ongoing support to our community. Talk about amazing leadership. Let's thank them. And their partner this evening, Random House Publishing, has helped to bring Professor Reich to our town, and we're thrilled with Random House for their support. Marin Magazine, the beautiful magazine of our town, has been a terrific sponsor of the Leadership Institute's lecture series, and thank you so much to Marin Magazine. Our special host tonight, Bank of Marin. Bank of Marin is dedicated to serving our community with financial strength, integrity, and commitment. And certainly, it is a model of leadership. Thank you so much, Bank of Marin, for your support. And all of the students you see here this evening in their polo shirts, these are volunteers. And our faculty as well and our staff volunteering their evening tonight. Thank them for coming out to help us. So to introduce Professor Reich is a Marin legend, Joan Capurro, Senior Vice President and Director of Community Relations for Bank of Marin. As one of Marin's leadership treasures, Joan is anonymous for Bank of Marin, known for community service. Her outreach is incredible. Last March, Joan was inducted into the Marin Women's Hall of Fame, a richly deserved honor, and it is my pleasure to introduce my friend, Joan Capurro.
She read everything just as I told her. Thank you, Denise. It's really a privilege to introduce the professor tonight. You know, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, the number of Americans living in poverty hit a 51-year high last year. Unbelievable. The gap between the rich and the poor in this country has never been wider. Robert Reich thinks he knows why, and I believe that. He is a former Harvard University professor who is currently Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. He also is a television commentator who blogs, I have no idea what that is, by the way, who blogs and writes about politics. His articles have appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal. Mr. Reich is a co-founding editor of the American Prospect magazine, and he has authored 11 books. Now he may have a bestseller on his hand, and that's not a problem, with his new book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Professor Reich explains the reason there is no real economic recovery is the record level of inequality between the wealthy and the poor. This, in turn, has left the middle class incapable of keeping pace with goods and services as in the past. In Aftershock, Professor Reich offers a detailed and thoughtful blueprint plan for dealing with the challenges, and it will take a lot more than bailouts. Gave ours back. The real choice ahead, Professor Reich notes, is between fundamental reform and inexorable action. Oh, I need to go back to college. He is here tonight to explain, and it really is my privilege to introduce Professor Robert Reich.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Joan. Thank you, Joan, and thank you all for coming tonight. And Dr. Lucy, thank you for your wonderful work in the Leadership Institute. Dominican University, thank you for sponsoring this event. And also that wonderful, wonderful independent bookstore, Book Passages. I mean, we need independent bookstores, and we're all going to support them. Make sure they continue. I'll go for about 45 minutes tonight and then take your questions. Is that about right? Is that okay? Can you manage 45 minutes? I sometimes ask people in advance because otherwise, you know, I can go on. I belong to the Fidel Castro School of Oratory. I can keep on talking forever, but I'm going to limit myself tonight. And I wanted to talk about with you the Great Recession and its aftermath, the aftershock we are now in. I want to start out with good news. In fact, I'm going to talk to you about good news and then where we've been and why we are where we are right now. And then I want to talk to you about the future, that is the choice ahead. And finally, I want to tell you why I am optimistic. First of all, I'm sort of starting with the good news and ending with the good news. Let me start with the good news. Some of you may have heard that last week, a group of economists working for the National Bureau of Economic Research that tracks the business cycle determined that, wait for it, the Great Recession is over. Don't you feel terrific? Well, actually, even better, it ended a year ago, June. It's amazing. I was flabbergasted when I heard it. I'm being facetious, of course, not about their finding. They did find that the Great Recession did end, that is, the contraction. You see, what happens in a recession officially is that economies contract, that economic activity gets slower and slower, and then it reaches bottom, and that's what happened. It reached bottom, according to this panel of economists, in June of 2009, and then the economy begins to expand again, and that's called officially a recovery. The problem is, as you all know, and I gave that little piece of news to you tongue-in-cheek, because most Americans, including, I gather, I would suspect most people in this room, don't really feel that things have changed all that much, right? I almost heard an amen just then, somebody down here, which is not good news at all. In fact, most people, when they hear that there is, not that much danger of a double-dip recession, they say to themselves, I'm still in the first dip. I never got out of the dip. I'm still dipping. I'm in the great long dipper here. And this great recession has just leveled everything in its path. It is obviously taken away huge numbers of jobs and homes and savings. Well, I can tell you, 2.5 years ago, I was 5'10". Taken a lot out of me. But it is really no laughing matter. But there's extraordinary confusion about what happened. And I want to talk to you about what happened as a prelude to what we need to do in the future, what is likely to happen in the future, because a lot of people are still very confused. We're still in the aftershock. That's why I chose the name of the book. It doesn't seem to be ending. There's not what some people had predicted, a very rapid return to normalcy. In fact, there is no return to normal, because normal is the thing that got us in the problem in the first place. And let me explain. Now, when the media, or really when anybody thinks about how the Great Recession started, we all think about Wall Street. And that's true. Wall Street's excesses did form the proximate, immediate cause of the unraveling of the economy. But there is a deeper reason. And that deeper reason actually is epitomized in a way by a conversation that I had just after Barack Obama was elected president. He summoned a group of his advisors together to talk to him about the economy. Among those advisors, I was there, and also Paul Volcker, Laura Tyson, who was formerly chairman of the CEA, Council of Economic Advisers, and a number of others. And we sat around a big table. It looked like the economy was getting worse and worse. Barack Obama was still president-elect. He had not yet become president. And he asked everybody, well, what's happened? Why the problem? And most people said, yes, Wall Street's excesses were the proximate cause, but the deeper cause was something else. And Paul Volcker, who is about 2 feet taller than me, he's very, very tall. And I went up to him before the meeting and I said, Paul, why do you think this thing happened? And he said at the table with the president, well, the real underlying reason is Americans spent too much. We just spent beyond our means. And that is certainly a way of looking at it. That is, we borrowed too much, we spent too much, Wall Street lent us too much, Wall Street's excesses were really manifest in our borrowing more than we should have borrowed. We, collectively, that is. The Chinese lent us too much, they're still lending us too much. That's a whole way of talking about it and thinking about it. But right after he said that, that is, Paul Volcker, Barack Obama, President-elect Barack Obama, looked around the room and he said, does everybody agree? And I was troubled. I wasn't sure that that was the right answer. And Laura Tyson, my colleague at Berkeley, who was, as I said, chair of the Council of Economic Advisers under Bill Clinton, said, I disagree with Paul Volcker. I think that the real problem is not that Americans spent beyond their means, but that their means did not keep up. And Laura was absolutely right. Because if you look at the last 3 decades, and you look at what's happened to wages, adjusted for inflation, even though the economy over the last three decades, the American economy has expanded considerably, it's much bigger, even with the Great Recession, it's still much bigger than it was 3 decades ago. But if you look at wages, particularly the median wage, that's the wage smack in the middle, half of the population of workers is above, half below. The median wage was completely stagnant. In fact, by 2007, the typical male worker in the United States was earning less, adjusted for inflation, than the typical male worker earned 30 years before. Now, that's quite staggering when you think about it, because the economy over 30 years grew much larger. How can it be that the typical male worker saw none of those gains? And, of course, today, the typical male worker is even worse off after the Great Recession. What happened? Well, not only what happened, but also how was it that the typical family continued to spend? That's another mystery. Because if they didn't spend, then the economy would have crashed long ago. But for almost 30 years, we had business cycles, we had recessions, we had expansions. For almost 30 years, Americans kept on spending as if the median wage had gone up. How do you explain that? Well, I explain it in the book by virtue of 3 coping mechanisms. I call them ways in which the typical family kept up their ability to spend even though the wage rate of the typical worker was flat. One coping mechanism was, first, and many of you are involved in this, and I certainly and my family is involved in it, the first coping mechanism was women going into paid work. Beginning in the late 70s, and to a greater and greater extent in the 80s and 90s, women went into paid work. Now, just to give you an example of how dramatic this change has been, in the 1960s and early 1970s, only 20% of women with young children were in the paid workforce. Today, to the extent they have jobs at all, 60% of women with young children. And if you look at very young children, children who are under four, it's even more dramatic, the difference. I mean, we went from about 10% all the way up to 55%. Never before have we seen, at least in the workforce, a social change this dramatic. Now, I wish I could tell you that the reason was because of all of these wonderful professional opportunities opening for women. And that was part of the reason, certainly for professional women and well-educated women, that was part of the reason. But the major reason that most women went into paid work in such large numbers was to maintain family incomes and standard of living when male wages stagnated or dropped. And that was coping mechanism. I call that coping mechanism number one, because eventually it was exhausted. We came to a point where it was not possible for that many more women with young children to go into the workforce. And so what did families do? They turned to what I call coping mechanism number two, which was everybody who was working in the paid workforce worked longer hours. By the mid-1990s, when I was Secretary of Labor, I looked at the data and was amazed to discover that the typical worker was then working 350 hours a year longer than the typical worker in Europe, longer even than the typical industrious Japanese worker. We were working all hours. In fact, very often you had a family in which both the father, mother, husband, and wife were both working long hours. They were almost working in shifts. I called these families, I had a demographic term I was very proud of. I called these families DINS, D-I-N-S, double income, no sex. And then, of course, you come to the end of that second coping mechanism, because there are only a certain number of hours people can put in. And we get to the past decade and coping mechanism number three, which was to go deeper and deeper into debt, which was relatively easy to do as long as housing prices were going up, because you could use your homes as collateral. And so people refinanced their home or got home equity loans. And between the year 2002 and 2007, just those 5 years, Americans extracted $2.3 trillion from their homes. This was an extraordinary amount of money. And again, it was relatively easy to finance all of this because home values were going up. And because home values were going up, lenders, banks, and so on were willing to provide all of this financing. But like all bubbles, that debt bubble eventually burst. Housing prices stopped rising, the housing bubble burst. And now we are where we are now. In fact, where we are now is essentially without any more coping mechanisms. That's one way of viewing it. American families simply have no way of avoiding what we have essentially tried to avoid for three decades, and that is the reality of stagnant wages, if we are lucky enough to have a job. Now, all of this raises and must raise in your mind several questions. I mean, one question that you must have if you followed what I've said up to now is, what happened to all the money? I mean, the American economy continued to grow, and if median wages were flat, where did all the money go? Class? You can't talk all at once. That's not. I'll give you a clue. It went to the top. It's more than a clue. And by the way, whenever I say this, somebody always says, well, you're a class warrior. You're blaming people. I'm not blaming anybody. And in fact, I think it's wonderful that a lot of people made, not a lot, but a lot of people, relative to what could otherwise be the case, made a lot of money in those years. But here's the problem. And it's a problem that was put into sharp relief for me when I read, after I had started researching this book, I read, or came across by accident, really, I did read, but it was accidental. I read a treatise, a book that was written by somebody named Mariner Eccles. How many of you have heard of Mariner Eccles? One, two, three, four. You know who Mariner Eccles? Five? There are about 14 of you. Mariner Eccles was, well, here's a way of getting into Mariner Eccles. If you go down to the Federal Reserve Board building in Washington, the Federal Reserve Board in the building, and that Federal Reserve Board is the most important economic policy-making group in the world, they have a building on Constitution Avenue. It's kind of a long, low, white, mausoleum-like structure, very few windows. But you will notice, if you go in there, and I used to go in there every couple of weeks to have breakfast with Alan Greenspan when I was Secretary of Labor. I was thinking about making some remark about that, and I won't. And it's called, this building is called the Mariner Eccles Building. The Federal Reserve Board is in the Mariner Eccles Building. And I know people who work in the Fed, and I've mentioned to them Mariner Eccles because I've been doing a lot of work and my research involves Mariner Eccles, and they don't know who he is. Mariner Eccles was chairman of the Fed from 1934 to 1948, very critical years. But more to the point, Mariner Eccles, who was a brilliant man and also one of the richest men and the biggest industrialists, one of them, west of the Rocky Mountains in the 1920s, Mariner Eccles looked at the Great Depression, first the great crash of 1929, and was shaken to the roots. I mean, he didn't know how to explain it. He was an industrialist. He had a whole string of banks. He was the largest owner of banks, again, west of the Rockies. Mariner Eccles, one of 21 children, by the way, from a big Mormon family. His father had come from Glasgow, Scotland. Mariner Eccles was dumbfounded by the crash and by the fact that the Depression kept on going. It contravened and contradicted everything that he understood about the economy. And finally, he had a crisis of confidence of a sort, I guess you could call it an Alan Greenspan moment, where suddenly everything he believed, he realized was wrong. And when it came to explaining the Great Depression, what happened, Mariner Eccles explained it as such. And it's very important you understand Mariner Eccles' explanation for the Great Depression because there are very strong parallels. Mariner Eccles said, the Great Depression occurred because so much income and wealth went to the top in the by the late 20s, starting much earlier, but by the late 20s, so much income and wealth had gone to the very, very top, the richest Americans, that the vast middle class and working class, the vast bulk of Americans, no longer had the purchasing power they needed to keep the economy going without going into debt. And eventually that debt bubble burst. Mariner Eccles also said that because so much wealth and income were concentrated at the very top, the people at the top began to speculate with their wealth and their income. They speculated in stocks and real estate, and they speculated in commodities, and that speculative bubble, like all speculative bubbles, also burst. And hence, we had the Great Crash and the Great Depression. Now, Mariner Eccles did not know something I know, because some of my colleagues at Berkeley have done research on income distribution using tax returns, very, very precise research going back to 1913, and what they have discovered is something, again, Mariner Eccles didn't know precisely, but I know, and I'm going to share it with you. And that is that if you go back to, say, the late 1970s, not that long ago, the top 1% was getting about 9% of total income in this country. But after the late 1970s, something began to happen. Income began to concentrate more and more and more. By the time I was labor secretary in the mid-1990s, the top 1% was no longer taking home 9%. The top 1% was getting about 15 to 17% of total income. And by 2007, the peak year, 2007, the top 1% was getting 23.5% of total national income. From 9% in the late 1970s to 23.5% by 2007. Now, if you go back in time over the last 100 years, there's only one other date where income concentrated to such an extent at the top that the top 1% had more than 23.5% of total income. And that year was 1928. And so I began looking closer and closer at the data and was astounded and surprised by the parallels. Now, again, let me pause here for a moment, because if you're following the argument, the next question you might have in your head is why? Why 1928? Why 2007? Why was there so much increasing concentration? If Mariner Eccles is correct about the Great Depression, then there may be something echoing about the Great Recession, and maybe some underlying structural issue is similar, but why did it repeat? What is going on in the American economy structurally, beyond the business cycle? Well, my suggestion to you, and again, I go into much more detail about it in my new book, Aftershock, my suggestion to you is that up until 1929, the Great Crash, the American economy was going through a great structural shift having to do with the development of mass production. High volume, centralized standard mass production, huge systems that generated great productivity, but not a great sharing of the fruits of that productivity because ownership was increasingly centralized in fewer and fewer hands. Something similar happened in the decades leading up to 2007, but it wasn't the same thing as ownership of huge industrial combines. No, it had to do with technology. New technologies that started in the late 1970s having a huge effect on the American economy. Let's take satellite communication technologies, containers, cargo ships, eventually in the 1990s, computers, and then eventually the internet, and related technologies, all of which allowed the production process to be parceled out around the world to wherever parts of it could be done most cheaply. And also, at the same time, lest you think that globalization is the only problem or outsourcing is the only problem, no, don't think that it is all about outsourcing, because many of those technologies replaced American workers directly. Remember, we used to have a lot of bank tellers? Some of you remember that in your own banks. There were a lot of bank tellers. My students don't believe that in order to make a deposit in a bank or to get money out of a bank, you once had to deal with a person. They find it absolutely incredible. Or to take another example, we had a lot of telephone operators. Remember those people? To make a long-distance call, you had to talk with somebody. We used to have service station attendants. Do you remember those? Okay, here. This is a test for you. How many of you remember service station attendants who would come out in uniform? Anybody? This is a very old group of people here. You know, when I was Secretary of Labor, it happened relatively quickly, this technological change. I remember going down, well, before I was Secretary of Labor, I remember taking my car, going down to the service station, and there were people. They would come out, and they would say things like, you want me to check your oil, or can I wash your windshield? And I mean, there was a conversation with people. And then years later, when I came back from Washington, I went down to the same service station. It was no longer a service station. It was just a station with no people at all. I could never find anybody. By the way, you know that you are no longer in the cabinet when you get in the back seat of your car and there's nobody in the front seat. It took me a while to adjust. I just sat there waiting. But in all these examples that I just gave you, and many, many others, it's not globalization that has taken away the jobs. It really is technology. And technology is as great a job substitute as has been foreign workers. Or you know, many people stop me and they say to me, we just have to get factories. We just have to get manufacturing back in America and everything will be fine. And I say to them, have you been in a modern factory lately? Because I have been. And if you look inside a modern factory, I'm talking about a state-of-the-art factory, and we do have some in the United States, and they are going up around the world as well, state-of-the-art factories don't actually have many employees. I was in one not long ago that had, it was humming, I mean, it was humming, it was huge production, but instead of a lot of people, there were 10, I counted 10 technicians sitting behind computer consoles controlling numerically controlled machine tools, robotics, various automated machinery. We fool ourselves into thinking that the old assembly line, labor-intensive assembly line, will be coming back anytime soon. It won't be coming back ever. I mean, unless we want to be neo-Luddites and smash all the technology and the machinery, we're not going to get these kinds of jobs back, just like the bank tellers or the telephone operators. So anybody who is involved in routine production, which was a lot of this workforce that we have, just doing the same thing over and over and over, was endangered, is still endangered, and is endangered not just by exports or imports or international trade over there, outsourcing over there, but as endangered, if not more endangered, by software, over there or software. Either one, routine, do it over and over again type jobs are disappearing. Now, it doesn't mean jobs are disappearing. In the 1990s, when I was labor secretary, Bill Clinton presided over an economy that created 22 million net new jobs. So it's not directly that they take that all technology and globalization are taking jobs away, because we've had periods not that long ago when we had a lot of jobs. No, the problem is wages. Going back to my initial point, stagnation of wages. It's hard to build wages if you are so easily replaced over there or software. You have to find a job. Many people in the local service economy, retail or restaurant, hotel, hospital, healthcare, surface transportation, childcare, elder care. There are a lot of jobs. The problem isn't jobs, it's wages. These jobs pay very little. But the knowledge-intensive jobs, the jobs that require a great deal of education, a great deal of training, a great deal of skill, and also the right connections, especially the CEO jobs and the top executive jobs and the Wall Street jobs and the finance jobs and the hedge fund jobs. These jobs have taken advantage of technology and globalization. These jobs have never paid nearly as well. And hence the gap keeps growing and income and wealth keep concentrating. And the question really that I got to after I examined all of this is, well, how did we change from that degree of concentration going up to 1928? We got to, if you followed me, by the 1970s, we had only 9% of total income going to the top 1%. Remember, there's one peak here, 1928, a tremendous concentration of income, and then we have the Great Depression, and then we have World War II, and then we have the 1950s and 60s, and we have the early 70s, and by the 70s, only 9% of total income is going to the top 1%. But then the pendulum seems to be turning around about 1980, and then we have more and more and more and more concentration leading up to 2007. So what explains that period? I've given you a theory about why you had greater concentration up to 1928, and why you had great concentration up to 2007, but how do you explain that period that goes through the New Deal and through the World War II and is the 1950s and 60s and 70s, where it seemed to be the pendulum swinging in the opposite direction to more shared prosperity? Is that in our future? Is there really a pendulum? And if there is a pendulum, why does it swing that way? Well, here's the heart, I think, of the question about where we're going now and the choice ahead. What Franklin D. Roosevelt started to do, although he didn't really know he was doing it, he was an experimenter, he tried a lot of things, nobody really understood very much about what needed to be done. He reorganized the American economy, or at least began a reorganization that continued in the 50s and 60s. And Franklin D. Roosevelt, for example, enacted the minimum wage, Social Security, a 40-hour work week with time and a half for overtime, unemployment insurance, all sorts of things we take for granted now. What they did, along with a very important piece of legislation in 1935 called the Wagner Act, which legalized collective bargaining and therefore enabled people to join together in labor unions. All of these and other pieces of legislation began to give working people a little bit more bargaining power in terms of getting a larger share of the economy. And then after World War II, there was great pent-up demand. World War II, many of you remember, mobilized almost the entire nation. People who had not had jobs got jobs. They couldn't spend very much because we had a war. And so after the war, people had a lot of money in their pockets, and they spent that money, and they formed families. I was born in 1946, along with Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Cher. And we were all born in 1946 because why did the baby boom begin then? Because it's not complicated. My dad was in World War II, and he came home, and there was my mother. And then, you see, the 50s, you had this extraordinary expansion, not only in terms of a shared wealth, but also public investments, the GI Bill, that made a college education possible for returning GIs. The National Defense Education Act, which trained a whole generation of scientists and scientific teachers and teachers of mathematics. The National Defense Highway Act under Eisenhower, which created our entire national defense highway system, which really was not about national defense, it was really about our infrastructure, very basic infrastructure. And we also rebuilt Japan. And we also rebuilt Europe. We spent huge amounts as a nation, and yet, despite all that spending, and also given the far more equitable distribution of income, we managed to grow faster as a nation and as an economy than we have ever grown since. The 50s, 60s, and 70s. We also, by the 1960s, you remember after a huge debate in this country in very difficult times, we passed the Civil Rights Act and then the Voting Rights Act and 1965 Medicare. And we kept on expanding opportunity. We built public higher education to a extraordinary extent, the investments that we are living on right now, the legacy we're living on in terms of education, higher education, and also primary and secondary education, those investments we made in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, how could we afford all of this? Well, for one thing, the economy was growing so quickly that we could afford it because there were tax revenues coming in. And for another thing, we constructed a tax system that was very progressive. In the 1950s, nobody would accuse Dwight Eisenhower, by the way, who was president then, former general, Republican president, of being a socialist. I never heard it said. Or a radical. No, but under Dwight Eisenhower, the top marginal tax rate on the wealthiest Americans was 91%. Now, there were tax deductions and tax credits, but even the effective rate was so much higher than anybody is debating today. And yet, we didn't think that was confiscatory at all. We just simply assumed that that was necessary for a civil society. And so the question is, where do we go now? And that's the last part of my discussion with you, and then I'll take your questions. Where do we go now? What's the choice ahead? Well, Barack Obama, President Obama, did, and his economic team, they did learn one very important, out of two, they learned one very important lesson from the Great Depression. And that one great lesson, very important lesson, was when you have a financial contraction or a financial calamity, when there is a danger that banks cannot pay up, when banks have overextended themselves, made too many loans, and finally reality catches up with them, then if there is to be avoided a massive run on the banks, a kind of crisis of trust and crisis of liquidity, what you have to do is bail out the biggest banks. And you also have to flood the country through monetary policy with money. And you might have to also, as John Maynard Keynes suggested, you might have to make up the difference between where we could be at full capacity and where we suddenly find ourselves because people are so laden down with debt, you might have to have some fiscal stimulus as well. That was all an important lesson of the Great Depression, something that Franklin D. Roosevelt didn't know at the time. And his failure to know it made the Great Depression worse. In fact, Franklin D. Roosevelt came into office as a budget balancer. Herbert Hoover and Andrew Mellon, his Treasury Secretary, and Franklin D. Roosevelt, at least at the start, they all said that the answer is to balance the budget, which, of course, made things even worse. But President Obama and his team did not learn the second lesson of the Great Depression, which is if you really want to get the economy going again, out of a deep, deep, deep slump in which consumers basically cannot buy because most of the gains of economic growth have gone to the top, and there is no way they can borrow anymore because all of the systems of lending money have become more responsible, the only thing you can do is basically reorganize the economy. Reorganize it in a way that there is more shared prosperity. How do we do that? Well, I'm not going to give away the plot of the book because then you won't buy the book, and I want it. But here's one thing that I do not suggest. Some people who hear me talk about this say, oh, well, you, Reich, you must be a redistributor. What you're really talking about is taking money out of the hands of the wealthy and giving it to the middle class and the working class. You're just a redistributionist. You're just another one of those socialist types. And what I say back, and what I say in the book, is something that I believe in very, very deeply, and that is that the people at the very top have a huge stake in the kind of reforms that I'm suggesting. It is better and more profitable to have a smaller share of a growing economy than a large share of an economy that's basically dead in the water. It's also, I might say, more profitable to have a smaller share of a growing economy that generates a positive politics in which people are willing to collaborate and solve problems than it is to have a large share of a relatively stagnant economy that spawns a politics of anger. Because that's what we have right now, and that's where we're going right now. There is, in this election, this midterm coming up, more just plain anger than I have seen in years. And I think the anger, although it's directed, and it came out of originally the bailout of Wall Street, that, you know, the Tea Partiers got really going, and I don't really blame them on this front, because they saw that bailout and they said, no, it's a collusion between big government and Wall Street against the rest of us. And many people on the right, but many people also on the left, are angry and disheartened and cynical. My point is that when people are afraid, when they don't think the economy is working for them, when they are on the verge or already have lost their jobs, their homes, their savings, or could very well, they are angry and they are frustrated and easy prey for demagogues who say, well, the real reason you are in your fix is because of them. And them could be immigrants, or they could be Muslims, or they could be the poor, or they could be the rich. By the way, I'm not blaming, and tonight I'm not engaging in the politics of blame. I'm not blaming anybody, if you follow my logic. Or they blame any number of people. You listen to talk radio and talk television or talk, or any, it's actually Yale television. And the yelling decibel level is getting higher. Sometimes I'm pitted against somebody who has a different view than I have. In fact, it happened today. I was on Larry Kudlow's show. I don't know how many of you watched Larry Kudlow on CNBC. You don't need to. But I appear there about two or three times a week, and I kind of like doing it, because the issues are important, and I feel strongly about them. But at some point, I remember not that long ago, I was arguing with another person, and we came to the station break, and the producer said in my ear, you know, producers, they have a little earpiece that they put in your ear, and the producer said, Loki, I was here in California, and she was in New York, she said in my ear, she said, be angrier. I said, what do you mean, be angrier? She said, well, people are surfing through the channels, and they stop when they hear people really going at it. And they like kind of gladiator contests, and we're competing with other gladiator contests, and so you've got to be angrier. And I said, well, that's very uncivil. I think that people should be appropriately passionate, but not blame each other, not go after each other in that way. But she said, no, you have to. And I said, well, I don't want to. She said, you must. And then I lost my temper. But my point is that we have a choice, and the choice is ours to make, and it is also the choice of the people in our society who are best positioned and wealthiest and most powerful to affect change. And the choice is either between a positive politics and the kind of reforms that I am talking about that generate more shared prosperity, or very reactionary politics that not only blames and scapegoats, but also turns us against each other, against international trade. I don't know how many of you have seen the polls. Most Americans today think the trade is bad, not good. As I said, against immigrants, against many things that otherwise allow America to turn outward. But as in the 1930s, with the Smoot-Hawley tariff, we turn inward. We become isolationist, nationalist, xenophobic, because we are so insecure. That's the choice. I truly mean it. It's not left or right. And here's why, finally, my last point, why I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic because I am something of a historian. As you gather, I learn a lot from history, particularly American history. And what I learn from American history is that whenever we in this country understand the true challenge we are up against, we put ideology aside. We don't call each other or stop calling each other socialists or communists or fascists or whatever we otherwise do. We put ideology aside, we put party politics aside, and we get on with what has to be done. We did that between 1900 and 1915 in terms of the first progressive era that fought to get our politics back from the machines and back from the robber barons. We did that again in the New Deal. We did that again in the 1960s. Many of you participated in all of that. We did it again and again and again. And I think we will ultimately do it once again because we are a very practical and sensible people. The question in my mind is, how bad do things have to get before we all of us, see what we have to do? Thank you very much. Thank you. And now we have time for your questions. We have about 10 minutes. And I urge you, we have some microphones around, and I urge you to ask a question. And if I can't answer it, I'll just turn it into a question I can. So who wants to begin? Do I have an opinion on what will take to turn around the real estate market, and when will that happen? I do have an opinion about that, but it is tied into what I've said to you today. I think that if we continue with our present policies, and most people in this country just don't have the wherewithal to generate sufficient aggregate demand to pull the real estate market back up to near where it was in 2006, then we are going to see a very, very, very long period of time. It could be 5, 6, 8, even 10 years before we see the market return to 2006 levels. And it could be that long because, again, there's just not the purchasing power, and lenders will not be able to, by regulation, appropriately will not be able to take the risks that lenders took before. Now, the stock market will do much better because the stock market, of course, is global. And many companies that are now listed on the New York Stock Exchange or the American Stock Exchange, those companies have production all over the world. GM, for example, is making more cars in China and selling more cars in China than it is here. And global demand is going to be very, very strong in places like China and India and Brazil. But we here depend to a very, very large extent on aggregate demand from American consumers. Other questions? Yes. I'll repeat your question, because don't worry about the microphone.
I'm not as smart as you are.
You are as smart as I am. You've started out a question with, "I'm not as smart as you are." Yeah. Well, the question is, what is it about our society? I thought you were going actually in one direction, and you switched on me. I can take it in any direction. There are really two questions you asked. One is cultural. Has the U.S. culture changed from the 1930s or 40s or 50s to the extent that we now are greedier in some sense? Has our national character changed? And the second question is, what is there about people at the top that makes them I don't know how you put it, but it was sort of an accusation about people who are very rich. Why do they accumulate so much? All right. Why do we allow them? Why do we allow them? We allow them. There's a little bit of a we and them in your question. Well, your first question about national character, let me just deal with it very quickly. I don't think national character changes, certainly that quickly. It is true that the Depression and World War II were experiences that we, almost all of us, went through together, and so that by the time we went through them, there was more social cohesion, more of a sense of social solidarity. But anybody who watches Mad Men, anybody here watch Mad Men? It's a series on television that looks at the 1950s and 60s and reminds those of us who lived through the 50s and 60s that it was not all wonderful. In fact, African Americans were second-class citizens. Women, through most of that era, were also had very, very few opportunities and were objectified in very terrible ways. It was very materialistic, very greedy. So it's not as if greed changes or the quality of greed changes. You ask, secondly, why have we allowed the rich to accumulate so much? Well, interestingly, and this is a part I left out of my presentation, I don't want to spend very much time on this, so I'm going to limit myself to 2 minutes on this, but it's an important point. After the late 70s or early 1980s, we could have, as a society, done many things that would have closed the gap, even though, if you followed my argument, much of that gap occurred because of technology and globalization, but we could have tried to close the gap through investments in education, early childhood education. We could have made 14 years of school mandatory and free, or maybe 16. If we had kept on going down the road we were going in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, we could have done many things that would create far more opportunity and build the productivity of our people and invest in infrastructure and do all of the things that we were doing before. And we could even pay for it with a higher marginal tax. Now, I'm not suggesting Eisenhower. Don't get me wrong. I'm suggesting just a little bit of a higher tax. Right now, we have in this country extraordinarily wealthy people whose income is treated for tax purposes as capital gains, and therefore they are like Warren Buffett, who complains about it. Warren Buffett says, I should not be taxed at the same rate as my secretary. But Warren Buffett is taxed at an effective rate of 17%. So there are many things that we could do and could have done, but instead we did the opposite. We privatized and deregulated and cut marginal taxes, and we disinvested. We allowed tremendous deferred maintenance to build up. And with regard to our schools and our universities, we allowed tax revolts to dominate. Now, if you understand the thrust of my narrative, it is completely understandable that starting in the late 70s, the middle class would have said, I don't want to pay any more taxes. My income is now flat. In the 50s and 60s and 70s, I was doing very, very well. But now I'm going nowhere, and I'm scared. So those tax revolts are completely understandable. But the problem is, we didn't frame it large, in a large enough way. We didn't ask ourselves, how can we gain the revenues we need, and also ask the people who are best positioned to bear not Eisenhower rates, but just a little bit more than they're bearing now. Anyway, I could go on. Why did we do that? Why did the pendulum swing back? I think it was largely because we were mesmerized by a kind of market fundamentalism. Ronald Reagan was very popular, Margaret Thatcher in Britain. We had suffered double-digit inflation in the late 70s, even though much of that was because of the Arab oil embargo. We blamed government, and we kind of bought into this notion that government is bad and private markets are good without understanding the much more subtle reality, which is the government is constantly organizing and reorganizing and restructuring markets. It's not either or. It's really how we utilize both. Yes.
What happens to inflation if aggregate demand stays low as it is now? And if further on to that question, do we look like Japan, a lost decade? Thank you.
Yeah. What happens to inflation if aggregate demand stays as weak as it is? Well, the reality is there's no inflation. We don't have to worry about inflation. The big risk is deflation. And that is exactly as you said, that is what Japan has suffered. Deflation, in a way, is more dangerous. Deflation means prices actually start going down. If you exclude food and energy, which are always very volatile, and we never know what they are, they really respond to global conditions. But if you look at non-food and energy prices, there's reason to be concerned. I don't think that it's a high risk, but it is a risk that we are moving into deflation. Some of you may say, well, if prices go down, isn't that great? The answer is no, because if prices start going down, many people say to themselves, I'm going to wait to purchase. Because if prices are going down, why don't I wait till next week or next year? And if everybody is saying that, then aggregate demand shrinks even further. And we don't have any good tools with regard to fiscal or monetary policy to counter deflation. And that's what Japan discovered as well. I think that that great pendulum that I was talking about has a corollary with regard to long periods of time in which inflation is the major fear, followed by long periods of time in which deflation is the major fear. I think from the late 70s up until the Great Recession, the big fear appropriately was inflation. Now, and for the foreseeable future, probably for decades, the biggest fear is going to be deflation. Another lady, please. Yes.
I began to see a while ago that people who were laid off from jobs, many of them would start their own little businesses at home. And many of them actually felt like they got out of jail. And they started making money and they started becoming creative participants in society. And it occurs to me that very few government statistics really include those people. And so isn't it possible that the job itself as a way of working is disappearing? And isn't that sort of better news than there is? In other words, things may be better than they seem. And is it, my question also is, does the government have the capacity to measure what's really going on in our new society?
The question is, isn't it possible that many people are doing extremely well? They're starting their own businesses and they are freed from the jail of big bureaucracies, and so maybe things are much better than the government statistics show. That's, I think, the essence of your question. And the reality is that the Commerce Department, the Bureau of Economics, and also the Labor Department's Bureau of Labor Statistics both do measure startups. They measure individual business startups. There was a study recently by the Kauffman Foundation, which follows all of this, that actually analyzed all of the data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Bureau of Economics. And the Kauffman Foundation decided, and in fact there was a very big headline, I remember, about 6 months ago, saying that we had a record number of startups in this country over the past year. Now, I thought that was peculiar. I mean, if it's true, startups are great, and startups are small businesses, and they hire a lot of people, and that means things are great. But I contacted people in the government because I wanted to know exactly how they did those statistics. And they included as startups anybody who lost a job and therefore had to go to a temp agency. Anybody who became a contract worker because they had no choice but to be a freelancer. And I said to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, wait a minute, this is interesting because these are not exactly voluntary startups. These are involuntary temp workers and contract workers who would much rather have real jobs. So here's the conundrum in terms of government data. We have no way of differentiating between the happy, aggressive, gee, I'm delighted to be here startup, and the, oh my God, I wish I had a job, a real job, I'm killing myself, I have no job security, I have nothing, no thing, startup. And we have no way of knowing, except we have good reason to think that during an economic downturn, there are more of the latter than when the economy is doing better. Let's see. I see so many hands, and I don't know how to make a choice. You in pink. What's my opinion about the total level of debt? Particularly, you say, and I think rightfully, as a ratio of debt to the gross domestic product. I think it's a potential problem. And if you look at the out years, you can get very, very nervous. But if you look at the out years, you see that the debt projections are being driven mostly by healthcare costs and the baby boomers. The two together, boomers and healthcare costs, are almost 90% of the problem. Social Security, I was a trustee of the Social Security Trust Fund once. Social Security is not a huge problem. It can be mended relatively easily. Medicare is a huge problem, but Medicare is a huge problem because of that combination of rising healthcare costs and the boomers. The current deficit debt right now is totally different. It's apples and oranges. And we get those confused. We say, no, we shouldn't go into any deeper deficit or debt right now because that just adds to that long-term deficit debt. Actually, there is a good economic argument, which I happen to believe in, and that is if the private sector is deleveraging, if people are still unable and unwilling to buy, if there's inadequate aggregate demand, and if businesses are not going to expand capacity or jobs because there are not enough customers, then government has to step into the breach. This is, again, lesson number one from the Great Depression. And it may have to, in the short term, run even larger deficits. The debt-GDP ratio, you may know, in 1945 was 120%. It's nowhere near that now. And I remember my dad telling me when I was a little boy, Bobby, I was only four, my first economic lesson in 1950, Bobby, you and your children and your children's children are going to be paying down the debt of Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was not a Roosevelt fan. And I didn't know what a debt was, but it kept me up that night. I was so, I was scared to death. But the reality is that the denominator of that equation grew dramatically in the 50s and 60s. In fact, it grew so fast that the debt-GDP ratio, even though we continued to spend on the Korean War and the Cold War, and we continued to, we rebuilt Europe and Japan. As I said, we built highways, we did a lot. Nevertheless, we grew so fast that the debt-GDP ratio actually dropped. So the question we ought to be asking ourselves is how soon can we get back to rapid growth? That's the key question. Now, I don't want to keep you longer than you are able to be kept. So how many questions shall we, anybody? Two more questions. All right. So, yes.
Would we have been better off to let the banks sort themselves out and put the money towards the people who were losing their homes, having to pay skyrocketing interest rates on their bloody credit cards? Would that have been a better way of handling this?
It's an interesting question, and it will be debated, I guarantee you, for almost ever, because there are people who say we shouldn't have bailed out the banks. It was the big banks. It was just a waste. Now, I was talking recently to someone, an executive on Wall Street, who said, all of those bailout money, the TARP money, is going to be repaid very shortly. I mean, in fact, the U.S. taxpayers may come out ahead. But the other side of the coin, or the other side of that debate, is it's not so much whether taxpayers come out ahead. It's who was bailed out and who was not bailed out. Because eventually, even homeowners, we expect, given my answer to the real estate question, eventually everybody will be able to repay loans. I mean, eventually, the question is how long, but the underlying question is who was not bailed out and who was bailed out. And a lot of Americans feel like they were treated unfairly. Well, Wall Street was bailed out. Well, the question, or the point, wasn't a question. The point was the banks paid it back so fast, maybe they didn't need it. But judging from what I saw and the people I talked to, there was a real liquidity crisis, or a crisis also of trust. I mean, if we had let them all go down, a kind of Lehman Brothers march over the cliff, I think that probably there was a 60 to 70% chance nothing bad would have happened. But there's a 30 to 40% chance it would have been economic Armageddon. And if you're a policymaking maker, you don't want to take that chance at all. If I were going to do it all over again, and if I were advising Barack Obama, I would say, bail out the banks, but put some conditions on those bailouts. You've got to help the small banks, and you've got to help Main Street in terms of getting loans and small businesses. You've got to put some limits, strict limits, on bonuses and pay in the big banks. Number three, you've got to help homeowners reorganize even a simple Chapter 11 or a bankruptcy proceeding so that they can actually get their money back. In other words, there are a bunch of things that you could have said to the big banks that as a condition of getting these bailout loans, but very, very little was demanded. Time for one more question, and how do I make this decision? Yes, but this is, let me just say, this is the last question, so it's got to be a fabulous question. I mean, don't feel any pressure.
One of the things that has concerned me in statistics is how many jobs have been lost, but how productivity has risen, which says to me that the people who are left, who might be stuck, are the ones that are doing several jobs. I know statistically, and a couple of years ago, it was like 1.5 jobs. I bet now it's 2. And that says to me that there are a lot of women, there are a lot of men with families, there are a lot of middle people, middle managers, middle class, that are really tired. And I think that that we are really on the brink of something that needs to happen to help the people in that position, because if they can't fight it themselves one-on-one necessarily, because they'll lose their jobs. And I don't think collective bargaining necessarily is the answer. What do you see as the answer?
Yeah. Well, let me again refer you to my book for the answer. Not to be facetious. Right now, what is happening is that jobs are just beginning to come back. I think we will see over the next year or two a little bit of a diminution, hopefully, in the unemployment rate. But that doesn't solve the problem. One reason that jobs will be coming back is that so many people will have to settle for lower pay. They already are. Or they will have to go to a new job that pays less than the old job, or fewer benefits. Or they will just have their pay frozen, and inflation, although not much inflation is going on, there's a little bit of inflation, that will whittle away their wages and their benefits. Or the dollar will drop relative to foreign currencies, which is what's happened now. I think right now we're at a 6-year low relative to the euro. I mean, just it's plunging, the dollar. The dollar dropping is another way of creating jobs here by getting poorer, because it means everything we buy from abroad costs that much more. And we can move to Germany. Yes, that's a good way of ending an upbeat note. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to tonight's presentation from the Institute for Leadership Studies, Robert Reich, from Dominican University of California, heard worldwide on radio.dominican.edu.